And you're back with Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In December of 1903, on a windswept ocean dune in North Carolina, two bicycle mechanics from Dayton, Ohio, changed history. With his brother Wilbur watching nervously, Orville Wright successfully took off in a heavier-than-air-powered aircraft. He flew for 120 feet for just 12 seconds.
That short jump in the air launched the era of human flight. It was a dramatic accomplishment, especially for the two Wright brothers who never even completed high school. And they did it in a time when many people didn't believe that human flight was even possible.
Oh, the popular opinion was that anybody that took seriously the aspiration to fly was crazy. And many of them were.
That's David McCullough, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian. His latest book is The Wright Brothers, which tells the story of Wilbur and Orville Wright and the dawn of flight. He says, despite that popular idea that human flight was virtually impossible, there were a number of serious scientists working hard to disprove that.
People like Samuel Pierpont Langley, a Harvard astronomer and physicist. But the Wright brothers were different. They were untrained, self-taught, never went to college. And David McCullough says they not only figured out the theory of flight, but they also figured out how to be pilots.
And that is one of the basic differences between many of the theorists and the Wright brothers. It isn't just that they invented the first plane, the first flying machine, to carry a motor-driven machine that would carry a pilot, but they learned to fly it. And that is of the absolute utmost importance to understand.
Because it wasn't just theoretical for them.
That's right. Yeah. Wilbur had a wonderful analogy. He said there are two ways to train an unbroken horse. One is to sit on the fence and keep notes, and then retire to a comfortable chair and write a learned paper on how to tame an unbroken horse. The other is to get on the horse and ride it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did, and did so at huge risk to themselves. Anytime either one went up, he knew that there was a good chance he could be killed.
Right. At first blush, they seem almost like the most unlikely candidates to figure this out. I mean, they came from a humble background. They never attended college. And yet they end up solving one of the world's great technological riddles.
And they did it all themselves.
All by themselves.
It isn't just that they financed it themselves with their earnings from their bicycle shop, but that they figured it out themselves. And when they discovered that the data used, technical data used by people like Langley, was wrong, was, as Orville said, worthless, then they had to start all over again and become physicists. Nothing seemed to discourage them to the point where they gave up. Nothing. They grew up in a house that had no running water, no indoor plumbing, no electricity, no telephone, but was full of books. And their father, an itinerant minister, encouraged them, pressed them to read. They never even finished high school. It's humbling.
David McCullough, I want to ask you about the central challenge that they took on, which is so interesting. And it wasn't so much getting a flying machine off the ground and into the air as it was figuring out how to have a stable flight, a balanced flight, and really control the flight. So what was the breakthrough that the Wright brothers figured out?
Well, the first breakthrough was that they realized they had to study birds. They had to study soaring birds. In other words, birds that can get up there and just hang on the wind, not flap their wings at all. And they did that, and the local people at Kitty Hawk thought they were really loony because they're out there waving their arms up and down, twisting their hands and their wrists. And Orville said that learning how to fly by watching a soaring bird was like learning how to do magic from a magician. And they developed, the brothers, what they called wing warping, which was a way of twisting the wings so that they could bank and turn, fly in circles, fly in figure eights. The very first plane to fly in 1903 at Kitty Hawk couldn't do that. It could take off, stay in the air, and land. And it wasn't for another 2 years that they developed what was really the first practical airplane.
But let me ask you, though, about that very first flight, December 17th, 1903, on the wind-swept dunes of Kitty Hawk. Orville Wright, he flew 120 feet. He was airborne for just 12 seconds. And you say they barely flew a mile, but they had done it.
Yes, they knew they had it. They knew they'd done it.
But how did that very short distance represent such a huge success? Why?
Because it took off, stayed in the air, and landed at the same elevation. In other words, it wasn't going downhill like a glider does.
Yeah.
It went straight. And the motor they put on the glider was in itself a huge innovation. It was made out of aluminum. Nobody had ever made a motor out of aluminum before. So it was lightweight, but yet it had sufficient power.
But you write that those first historic flights were virtually unnoticed by the public.
They didn't care. They didn't believe it. The Dayton papers wouldn't even send a reporter out to watch.
It's incredible.
Our federal government wouldn't send somebody out to take a look. The brothers volunteered to bring the plane to Washington and to demonstrate there.
And was this because people just couldn't believe it?
That too, but I think in part, and I really don't think there's been much doubt about it, because the Langley planes had been such a disastrous failure and so much money had been spent on them, that the War Department was not about to get into that business again for a while.
I see.
They were very skeptical about it.
And it would be almost 5 years later in France when the public would finally take notice. You write that Wilbur demonstrated his flying machine before thousands of people and eventually demonstrated to hundreds of thousands of people. Describe that reception in Europe for what they were doing.
Well, the first demonstration was given on the eighth day of the eighth month in the year 1908 at Le Mans, the great racetrack town. And the French were very enthusiastic about aviation. There were many French aviators by then. They had not perfected anything like the Wright brothers' plane. And when they saw Wilbur fly, they said, well, they are way ahead of us, meaning the brothers. We are but children, one of them said, compared to them. So the enthusiasm, the popularity among the French was far ahead of us here in America. But these two brothers were far ahead of anything in France. The French aviators, without exception, were all very rich men for whom this was kind of a life-risking sport. You'd go out to watch the air demonstrations the way you'd go to the racetrack to see a horse race or something. It was fashionable. And once the greatest of racehorses ever known to the world, Wilbur Wright, arrived in France, they all had to come and see the wonder, had to come see the miracle. And he didn't speak French, and he was very modest, and he was very American, and they loved him for it.
Huh.
And the more American he was, the more they loved him. He was the most popular American ever to come to France since Benjamin Franklin.
That's amazing.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was thrilling.
Meanwhile,
and justly so.
Yeah.
Justly so.
Of course. Meanwhile, back in America, Orville was demonstrating the same thing, but he suffers a huge setback, an almost fatal accident, right? Tell us what happened.
Well, he was at Fort Myer Airport across the Potomac from Washington, and he took a young lieutenant up with him named Selfridge, and there was a mechanical failure, and the plane went into a nosedive, went straight down 75 feet. And Selfridge, unfortunately, was killed. First fatality in the history of aviation. And Orville was very nearly killed. Many broken bones, leg broken in two places. But also damaged psychologically, badly damaged. And his sister, Catherine, she was teaching school in Dayton. And she phoned their principal, said she was taking an indefinite leave of absence, packed her bag and was on the train that evening. She came to the hospital where he was being treated at the Army base, and she stayed in the hospital for a month and about a week or 10 days, seeing him through this, physically and psychologically. In many ways, she saved his life. Many people thought he might never walk again, and the idea that he'd not only walk again, but he'd fly again, and fly right there at the same spot where he was nearly killed, and break several world's records is to me one of the most marvelous comeback stories I've ever had experience telling.
It's a great comeback story. I'm glad you mentioned Catherine, because in your book, she's such a key character. You portray her as really one of the keys to the success of Wilbur and Orville Wright.
She was.
Yeah, tell us more about Catherine.
Well, she was the only one who went to college. She went to Oberlin, which was the first coeducational college in our country, and She was very bright, but very good grades. She was a tiny little woman, about 5 feet one at most. She had her hair pulled back in a bun and wore a gold-rimmed pince-nez glasses. She was the essence of the school marm. But she was also very funny. She was very opinionated, and she could get mad. Wrathy, as she said. And she kept those brothers in line. And she also was there whenever they needed her.
There's so much to admire about these guys, and what you taught me and what I admire about them even more is that they become hugely famous. I mean, they become celebrities. But you write that their celebrity never really changed them.
Didn't change them in the slightest. They gave them a lot more money, but they didn't care about that particularly. They were in it because they felt it was inevitable and that they could do it. They could solve the problem. And the fact that someone like Leonardo da Vinci hadn't been able to solve it didn't bother them at all. And they knew all about that. Yeah. They read everything there was about aviation. Wilbur wrote a famous letter to the Smithsonian saying, "Send me everything you have." I see this, my book, as number three in a trilogy. The first was my book about the Brooklyn Bridge, the second about the Panama Canal. All three of those were immensely important, momentous achievements, achieved at tremendous risk of life. Many people died building the Brooklyn Bridge. Many people died at Panama working on the canal. And certainly the Wright brothers were risking their lives all the time. But that history can be changed and human aspirations can be inspired, encouraged by achievements other than in politics. History isn't just politics and war. It has to do with the creative energy that we bring to art, science, medicine, music, poetry. And in many ways, those achievements count for more longer.
Mm, I agree with that, yeah.
Yes, it is true. And we should teach history that way. Mm-hmm. We should think of history that way. And somebody like the Wright brothers are an essential element in our story. They are vitally important, and it's a huge tribute to the human spirit, human mind. We should take inspiration from such an example, not feel, oh, well, we don't produce people like that anymore. Sure we can. Mm-hmm. Of course we can.
You know what I just love thinking about in reading your book is how recent it is. And when we think of
That's right.
What airplanes are doing today,
right.
It's just incredible.
It is incredible. I could have known Orville Wright.
Yeah.
He died in 1948. I was 15 years old. He might have been that nice old gentleman around the corner that was such fun to speak to.
Yeah.
And yet, we get in a plane today. We go up to 30, 35, 40,000 feet, think nothing of it. I just read the other day that Chicago's O'Hare Airfield, 70 million people flew in and out of there in 1 year, 2014, last year, 70 million. I was flying somewhere recently at 35,000. I'm editing one of the chapters of my book on the Wright brothers, and I stopped and I thought, wait a minute. Here I am sailing along with 300 other people, or however many were in that airplane, and we just take it for granted.
Yeah.
Orville lived to see rockets and jet propulsion, and of course he also lived to see the horrors brought to the world in World War I and II by the airplane as a weapon. Like you, I have been interested in aviation my whole life. I built model airplanes when I was a boy with paper, and it has been on my mind for a good long while. And yet, I didn't know anything about the immense reach of the minds of these two men from Dayton, Ohio.
Mm.
And you go into their bicycle shop, which is at the Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan, and their house where they grew up. It's humbling to think how this all came to be. They are pioneers every bit as much as those who went west and covered wagons.
Well, David McCullough, you've written a wonderful story. He's the author of The Wright Brothers, and he'll be speaking about the book tonight at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge. David McCullough, thank you. Such a pleasure.
Thank you.
And by the way, the Harvard Bookstore event tonight with David McCullough takes place at the First Parish Church in Cambridge. You can find more information at radioboston.org.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Our show is produced by Amory Sievertson, Emma Jean Weinstein, and Kathleen McNerney. We had help today from Jessica Alpert.
Tim Skoog is our technical director.
Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.